Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the AOMS Research Podcast. Today, we are joined by Dr. Mary Beth Geiser. We'll be discussing her AOMS annual conference presentation titled, Is Your Interest in Academia? A Roadmap to Prepare OMPTs in Their Transition. This presentation was co-presented with Drs. Michael Barassa, Jody Young, and Craig Grassinger. Dr. Geiser is currently practicing at Aurora Sport Health and Sports Medicine Institute, and she holds adjunct teaching positions in entry-level, post-professional residency, and fellowship programs. Dr. Geiser, thanks so much for joining us today.
Danu, thanks for having me here.
I'm always curious. Do you mind by starting into how you and your co-presenters came up with the idea to put this together?
Sure. What we ended up doing as part of the ACF SIG, so that's the Academic and Clinical Faculty Special Interest Group with AOMS, was pooling our thoughts together on what kind of questions had people been reaching out to the committee for. And then obviously when COVID came, we realized that there were some needs that the general public membership for AOMS had. And then as a result of that, we were working with different ideas for how could we help those interested in academics while we're at the next conference, which will be virtual, which is where all of us were kind of stuck in for teaching. And then through that discussion, we came about with, well, wow, there's probably a lot of people who are just interested in academics right now, let alone those interested in resources for teaching academics. So we did a big step back and we said, well, why don't we help those members out there who might have a little bit of an interest in teaching, kind of get their feet wet and help move them forward. And we looked and searched part of AOMS past agendas and really didn't see that there was a kind of like how to start type of presentation. So that's what we submitted to the committee. And then we were fortunate enough to bring that to fruition this year at 2020.
That's a very important topic to me, being a clinician moved into an academic. For those who didn't attend, can you give us a brief synopsis of your presentation?
Sure. What we ended up doing with the presentation was kind of breaking it down into four different parts where we each had our own area of expertise. So Mike came in and introduced just the concept and wanted everyone to understand kind of where our objectives were. So the first part of the objective was to just review the standards for the academic program faculty in an entry-level DPT residency or fellowship program, because many people out there, they don't really know what are the standards for faculty. And if you don't meet those standards, you actually can't get hired, right? And then we wanted to define the different roles between an academic requirement, a clinical faculty, core faculty, and just help everyone kind of look at what might be their niche for getting back into teaching. And then we started looking at just different expectations of the faculty, because some people, you might change what job you're looking at in academics depending on the expectation. And then we kind of each gave our little two cents on pitfalls or things we encountered for transitioning. So Craig started out by coming in and just introducing the topic of how do you want to teach and where do you want to fit in? So for those of you out there that are interested, just make sure you look at two options. Do you want to be an academic type faculty position where you can start like I did in a teaching assistant position, or maybe move up to some type of adjunct actual faculty position where you're hired or get contracts every year? Or are you really looking at getting a complete career change or maybe a career start as a core faculty member at an institution? And then again, we can go into some further conversations about whether or not you want to teach and do research, or predominantly do research and then have to teach on the side. So if you go through and you look at that first part, Craig just did a really nice job at the presentation, just helping everybody understand those faculty roles. And I think one of the things that people didn't understand with the faculty role is that that core faculty position has one extra piece, which is those three pillars. And these are requirements for CAPD. So if you want to be a core clinician I mean, a core faculty member at an institution, you have to also remember teaching is part of your job, service is part of your job, and research is part of your job. So those are those three pillars that he talked about for core faculty. If you're looking at that other side of the fence and kind of doing what I did, which is that academic type faculty, your jobs can wax and wane depending on the needs of the institution and also the size of the institution. So for those of you who don't understand, you really want to think about like what type of school or university are you going to work for? I've worked for everything from a large, you know, like R1 institution that is very high research activity to something that is looking at a doctoral or professional university where teaching is their main focus. I've also taught in a master's program where from that standpoint, you know, my job is to educate those students, move them forward toward their next advanced degree, but not necessarily have any research requirements. So when you go through those things, just remember, those are jobs that you want to ask about and read the job description and find out where you're at and what you're interested in. The second part of the talk that we did at AAMP was where I came in, and Craig just did a nice leeway into, well, Mary Beth, how did you get to where you are today? And I put up a couple slides on just my timeline. Where did I start? What worked for me? What were some pitfalls that I ran into? What were some jobs I got just literally by being in the right place at the right time and having the right mentor? And then I talked a little bit about jobs that I took that I really didn't like, whether it was because pay was not very good, the timing was not very good, or it's a class nobody wanted to teach, and that's why the job opening kept sitting there. And the director was looking for someone to teach that class. When you get through my part of the presentation, Craig did a good job too about just coming back and being like, well, what does it take to hire someone? And if he was looking to hire someone like myself or one of you that are out there in a teaching job, he just wanted to help give some little tips on, you know, what might be asked in an interview type standpoint. And then finally, of course, anyone trying to transition from the clinic to academics, which is what I did, or even from an academic position into something that's core, you give a nice set of tips for that transition. And obviously, the most important thing I think members need to understand when they're out there is that if you're a really good clinical instructor, you have potential to also work in the clinic and help students. But your other side is you might find a love that you like to mentor and you like to teach. And then if you like to mentor, but you don't really like to teach, that's kind of where Mike came in and talked about, well, what does it take to be a mentor in a residency or a fellowship program? Because those are also jobs that are out there in academics. And then from that standpoint, if you go into that position and you want to be a mentor, but maybe you don't want to take a core class, you got requirements that you need to meet, such as like looking for a specialty certification through APTA or even going forward and finishing up a fellowship program. Well, on the flip side of that, Jody's final part, which was our actually third leg of the presentation, was to talk about different degrees you could have in order to teach. So as you can tell from my credentials, I'm an OCS certified therapist, and I've had that since 1999. But I also went back and got a transitional doctorate degree after being a PT for quite some time. My most recent accomplishment was finishing my fellowship certification through Regis University, and then kind of moving forward with different avenues of teaching based on that. So if you had some questions regarding what else might have been in our presentation, there's a nice little short piece by Jody talking through the differences of that. What does it mean to have a DPT? What does it mean to have an EDD, so a doctorate in education and potentially leadership, curricular design, things like that? What does it mean to have a PhD and all the requirements that go with that in schooling? And then finally, other options that are out there, which is a DSC or a PsyD, an SCD. So those are all the different components that are listed in the presentation that we did at AAMP just this last year.
And for so many reasons, I think that's such a great presentation because, you know, I'm co-chair of admissions at our entry-level program, and so many people voice an interest in research and teaching, even coming into DPT school, and you can see those interests develop while they're in school. They do research assistantships, they look for mentoring programs where they can teach. And so you try to develop those processes, but really the DPT itself is a clinical degree. And so we're training people to be clinicians. And so once people get out and they're clinicians, it's really wondering, well, how do I do those other things? How do I get into research? How do I teach? And for so many people that specifically kind of pursue this advanced clinical training, whether it's residency, fellowship, any of those things, or even just have this intrinsic interest to help other people in teaching, there's not always a specific way to do it. And I think part of that comes from your presentation. There's multiple ways to teach, whether it's in the clinic, in academics, there's core faculty, adjunct faculty. So now that you've been doing this and kind of mentoring people along the way in the special interest group of AAMT, what barriers do you typically hear, or what do you often kind of see as kind of challenges for early clinicians or clinicians that have been at it for a while but transitioning for the first time into academics?
Well, I'll tell you, there's three big barriers that are out there. And a lot of it just depends on when you graduated from your original PT program. So I've been blessed to see some of my most recent students who've gotten their DPT already move forward with a small, like, adjunct teaching position. But they're walking into those jobs with their DPT done. So for them, it's hard to sell themselves because their experience is missing, right? For someone like myself, I needed to go back and get my transitional doctorate degree. And I had a really good mentor that kind of told me early on, Mary Beth, you need to do this. You need to put out the cash, put out the money, and move forward with a terminal degree. So the school that I was teaching at that moment actually said, well, we'll give you credit for every class you've already taught for us. How many more credits would you need to finish your transitional doctorate degree? So the hardest thing for me at that moment was that my career was kind of already set. I was in the clinic, I was seeing patients, I was enjoying what I was doing, and I was loving this little teaching job, lab assistant position that I had on the side. The hardest part was going back and making a transitional DPT work within my family life with little kids at home. So if you're a new person out there and you have a DPT already and you're trying to move into a teaching job, the barrier for you is going to be your experience. So start making a name for yourself. Try to find a topic that you're very good at speaking with, or find a mentor that can help you find one or two things that you know you can hone down. If you're a PT that's been out there that hasn't thought about a DPT position, as 2020 moves forward for just our profession as a whole, we want everyone out there who are interested in moving forward with academics to have their DPT. You need to have at least the degree that you're issuing out. So those are kind of like the first two barriers. The third barrier that's out there is actually someone that is kind of stuck. They have what they need, but they don't know where to go. And those are kind of the questions that we got when we were finishing up our talk. If people would reach back out to me afterwards by email and saying, wow, I didn't realize the problem with getting into academics was not knowing what I wanted to do. So I didn't know there were these options that were out there. I didn't know there was ways to start really small and then go big. So I kind of see each of those as being different barriers. And I guess one that we didn't really talk about a lot, I mentioned it a little bit on my type of presentation, my little couple set of slides, was geographically, it might be hard to teach. I'm fortunate to live in Wisconsin and be in an area where within an hour of my house, there's multiple schools I could teach at, okay? But you might be in an area where you are geographically not close to a place to teach. So if that's your barrier, you need to start looking for adjunct jobs or teaching jobs where those classes are online. They're in a hybrid or a blended format. And you just got to bite the bullet and move forward and try one of those avenues. So if you're not familiar with different platforms for schools and how to teach, those are the mentors that I would recommend that you maybe think about pursuing and moving forward with. So is there anything else, Dinda, that I can answer for you related to that question?
No, I think you really addressed the main barriers that I hear about very frequently. You know, in my role, full-time teaching in orthopedics, I probably get, whether it's weekly or every other week, a question, a random cold call email, you know, how do I get into teaching? Is there a possibility of me doing a lecture with you? Can I go ahead and teach in your class? Those types of things. And I actually didn't have the barriers you mentioned because I kind of fell into it, you know, right out of school. I started teaching in the clinic basically like my second week, and it was because someone was sick that day. I became CCCE really quickly because someone became a manager and then had to fill that role. And then I started adjuncting pretty much my second semester out, you know. So all these positions just came available to me, and those opportunities led to me developing the interests versus the other way around of having an interest and then pursuing it. So I appreciate you kind of identifying those barriers for people that have an interest and are starting into thinking about how to pursue that interest.
Well, it's interesting you say that luck was kind of on your side, because that's been part of my love for this teaching job, is that I've just been lucky, and like you, been in the right place at the right time. My first ever job that I got teaching in cardiopulmonary, I was in a lab running the kind of the routine for the students, and found out with pretty short notice that the professor I was teaching with had to step out because of a medical situation with his family. And lo and behold, another PhD comes in and introduces herself and says, "Hey, I'm here to cover. I heard you've done this lab before. I'm literally just another body in the room. Here's my expertise. Let's get started." And by the end of that lab session, I noticed she was walking out of the room with a limp. And I had said to her, "Hey, what's going on there? Is there something I can help you with?" We had this long conversation about her Achilles tendon tear and the rehab she was getting, and the lack of progress she was having. And I said, "Well, are you interested in some of my manual therapy skills? I'd be happy to take a look at your ankle." Well, that conversation definitely developed into my next job, where she didn't realize I had skills in manual therapy. And that was another area of expertise that I could convince someone that I was good at. And that one encounter, that accidental kind of mishap, I would say, in lab, which of course was seamless to the students because they're just there to learn and teach the class, ended up being a job that I had for about 12 years teaching in an exercise physiology lab. So luck is on your side. I would definitely take advantage of that. And if it's something that you're not sure if it was maybe fate in your face, I'd take a big step back and maybe self-reflect on that moment and see if there's an opportunity that you can just reach out and grab.
Yeah, and for me, that was a big thing, is not saying no when you're first thinking about things. And so I stepped into a teaching anatomy lab, and I feel really bad for those students that I was helping out because I had no idea what I was doing. And then I started teaching in modalities and foundations of examinations, which again, isn't necessarily my specific interest in orthopedic manual physical therapy, but it got me in the door. And then those doors continued to open and open and open. And then having mentors allowed me to have more doors to open then. So in that way, being lucky is helpful, obviously, but then being willing to push the boundaries of what you're interested in, what you think you're interested in, I think that's going to help if you're interested potentially in academics.
You brought up one other really good point, is just look at the classes that we've already talked about just in this podcast, right? Cardiopulmonary, exercise physiology, modalities, anatomy. These are classes that prior to COVID required a high amount of lab time, right? So maybe think about those classes for opportunities to start, or opportunities where small amounts of help might just be needed for a little bit of time.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, the courses that have labs need people to fill those labs. And I know a lot of programs are moving toward more of a hybrid model, especially right now. Some of that's probably going to stick, and there's probably going to be a need for virtual teaching, but there's also always going to be a need for bodies, for experienced and expert bodies. So I think there's always opportunities. I wonder, I know I had a number of things that I was surprised at when I moved from my clinical position right after doing a fellowship to a core faculty role. When I was adjuncting, it was very different from when I was a core faculty member. What were some of the bigger surprises for you coming into a teaching role compared to being primarily in the clinic?
So I guess one of the things that was a big change for me taking over a teaching position compared to just being, say, responsible for a student in the clinic is the word student versus students, plural. So as soon as you take on a teaching job, remember, anyone that interacts with you is someone that you have to connect with. So you need to find a way when you are getting into teaching of getting that connection with the students, and that's plural. So the first 20 students you meet might think you're great and awesome and you connect with them. But learning how to reach out to the students that you don't connect with is probably a skill that takes some time. And I would definitely reach out to your mentors while you are looking at different teaching jobs to work on your connection skills. Okay. When you see another big challenge for those of us interested or going into academics or even talking like flashbacking to our earlier career, the other thing that I noticed is that the size of the program is actually very influential. So larger programs sometimes require larger amounts of work. If you're starting out as a lab assistant and you have to clean the lab, you know, three times because you can only have 20 students in at a time, that's got to be part of what you agree to do. Now, on the flip side of that, a smaller school doesn't necessarily mean smaller amount of work. So the establishment of the school, how old is that PT program? How much staffing shifting has occurred or turnover in the last year? I worked for one small school where, you know, staffing was brand new all at one time. So even though this program might have been running already previously under a different guidance or a different director or even a different set of faculty, walking into that teaching job was something that required a lot more work. Now, that job was more than worth it for me because I'm still teaching for them. But those are the things that I don't think anyone thinks about when they go into academics. And then I would say the other thing that's hard is just really making sure you sit down with your partner, your significant other, even just your kids, and saying, you know, this is really important to me. And I would tell my young kids, it's really important for mom to be teaching. And I love this and I do this and it's going to make me a better person and help me help you. But when I have to come home late at night again or not do something on a weekend because I have to grade, then that's one of the things that was hard for them to understand. And again, like you can probably attest to, the larger class you take, the higher responsibility you have, it's always grading. Okay. And as Craig would say in his one slide, the day is never end at 5 o'clock. Like you might be done teaching, you might have your lab cleaned up, you might actually be getting in your car, but your brain is kind of on, right? So you either need to use those moments to set them aside and write a lecture, think about an assignment, figure out how you're going to deal with the student program, and then find the time to turn that off. But just because the clock ends doesn't mean that our jobs end as faculty.
For me, that's actually the biggest point, and that was the biggest surprise for me, is coming from a clinical position, you know, you can kind of split your schedule. For me, I was doing 4:10s, and then I would have a day off, but usually I would go in at 7, I'd be done whenever my notes were done, and then I was done for the day. I would check various journals and things on my own, but that was on my own time, and I was not responsible for anyone else for that time. With teaching, what I've learned is that the time doesn't really matter anymore. Like it's always on. And your point about kind of sitting down with other people in your family and your life, it's really important. You know, for me, I have two little kids and a wife who's a PT. So they know that certain times dad has to do certain things, you know, but the emails don't stop. The prep doesn't stop. I constantly thought that my professors, when they weren't in class, they were just puttering around on like ESPN or something like that. But I found out the hard way that it's actually a lot more work. I love it, but it is more work. And then, so that's something I would say for people going into it and thinking about it, is just preparing for a lifestyle change. Obviously you can maintain a balance, but it's a very different balance, I think.
Let me add one more thing in there just really quick, if that's okay, about lifestyle change, right? So here's the other thing I think everyone needs to think about when they're transitioning from the clinic, okay, which is kind of that, like you had mentioned, that forced schedule, right, to academics, and what can be any level of academics. I think as a person, you need to decide, am I an early morning person? or am I a night owl? Or can I wax and wane depending on those two? Because like you had mentioned before, how many of us thought, oh my gosh, my professor should be available right now. It's 5 o'clock in the early evening and I want to try to hold of them and I want to hand my assignment in by 9 o'clock at night, right? Well, here we are at home triaging family, life, kids, dinner, laundry, you know, whatever it is making sure that you look at those options for you. And sometimes the job you decide to take might better fit one of those lifestyle changes. And then the other thing with that is just moving forward is what if you are a night owl, but your institution, your school demands, your brain just works better under these conditions at a different time of day. And if you're not ready to make those lifestyle changes, sometimes, again, a good opportunity to get a mentor, or as Craig would say, start low and go slow. Let's try one little switch in my lifestyle change and see if that fits and see if that job was good or a bad decision.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, finding time to, you know, self-reflecting on when am I most productive? When do I have the time? And then using that time effectively. For me, I found that's especially essential now that I've started another academic degree. So I would completely echo that point. I also wonder from your experience, because, I mean, obviously you've published, you've done some presentations nationally, regionally, but getting into those types of things for a clinician can be tough. And when you think about the three pillars of service, research, and clinic, when a new clinician or a seasoned clinician is coming into academics, we see their resume, their CV, it's heavy on the clinical side. It might be a little bit beefier with the service from maybe chapter participation or service to the community. The research or the scholarship tends to be lighter for most people. What suggestions do you have for clinicians to at least start into the process of getting involved in scholarship, knowing that it's hard to expect a new clinician or a seasoned clinician, first-time academic, to have 15, 20 publications or grant funding at all, you know? What right. suggestions do you have for a clinician that's trying to scale out their CV so that they have a little bit in each bucket?
Right. So let's just kind of look at where the CV could go, okay? You need to have those three pillars for someone else to look at hiring you, especially in a core faculty position. So if you're lacking in service, I would try to go out and find service opportunities. For sure, start with your district or your chapter in your state. Make an opportunity appear. So go out and get on a nominating committee for a chapter, or try to work on a legislative day. I've done that numerous times in the past and been very, very blessed at those opportunities, helping with prepping for Senate hearing committees, working on legislative bills. Those people remembered my hard work and they became my early letters of recommendation. So even though I wasn't really doing teaching at the moment, they could vouch for skills that were needed to be a faculty member, right? Organization, hard work ethic, and knowing how to get a job done and actually working under pressure. The other thing that you can do from a service standpoint is go out there and see where there's other volunteer opportunities. Numerous times I did free talks for the soccer club that my kids were part of that were, as I would say, PT related, or at least in my area of expertise, which early on was orthopedics. The other thing you can do for a service is look at your church, look at your community. What are the things and the needs that that particular area of service is beneficial? So you could be running some type of free lectures or talks at your area church or congregation. You could also be going to a Rotary Club and volunteering your time to talk there. Some of the former patients I had in the clinic were actually my best advocates for me to get into these service positions. And I would talk to them about, does your company need me to come out and just talk about why sitting is the new smoking? Does your company need me to come out and do some free ergonomic assessments at the desk and at your site? Are there things that could be a general wellness talk that all of your employees could use just for stress management? So those little acts of service, as I would say, are good ways to kind of beef up your CV for working through there. if you have to go and look at teaching opportunities, one of the things that really helped me early on with all of this was volunteering my time to do some various lectures. So I was well connected within Marquette and just kind of called on some previous professors that were maybe working at different places and say, how could I get my foot in the door here? I think I could do a short lecture on patellofemoral pain. And then that person would give me feedback on what worked, what didn't work, and how should I really maybe beef that up next time? Or what would it be different if this is a PTA versus a PT program, right? And then lo and behold, that person offered to put a good word in for me at the other institution and say, hey, I saw her do this patellofemoral lecture. Are you interested in her doing this by you? So that was like my early teaching type stuff, right? But the other part of that teaching is maybe taking some time and going on some continuing education courses in a topic where you see jobs are posted, right? So if I did McConnell taping and patellofemoral pain, but I'm noticing that there's a call out for shoulder lectures or help in a shoulder lab or pretending to be a patient at another school's oral practical exams in maybe their neurology class, maybe I should take some continuing education courses on that topic so that at least I can be well-versed in that avenue. And then the other way that you can do like this teaching and this service and kind of put it all together is put yourself out there and call these schools and say you're interested in helping with their admissions program. Right, I have sat in at so many new potential student interviews that alone helped me learn skills that I think carried over into my teaching career related to how can you talk on the fly or can you do PT improv at a faster rate? Because nothing's more nerve-wracking than sitting in a student interview when no one in the room has anything to say, right? That's the job of the moderator of those interviews to kind of jump in and be able to improv on the spot and actually pick something out of that student's CV or their application and start a conversation. So learning those skills are indirect ways that you can kind of get yourself ready for those teaching jobs. Now, one last thing, if that's okay, talking about research, it's actually been quite interesting. I've tried numerous times to actually get a full publication published and out there, and I've been rejected many times. So when somebody else came to me and said, hey, are you interested in helping me with this publication? I said, sure, I can help you and do some mentoring. And lo and behold, that's the one that gets published. I'm like, dang it, that was easy. I should have just found other people that need more help. Those are maybe where my skills are, right? But along the way, I've been able to publish some abstracts. I've been able to work on projects with students and their abstracts and their posters and their presentations. And if you're trying to get your CV pumped up in any shape, way, or form, those might be the avenues that you have skills for. Call those schools and say, is there a clinical practice program, or is there an evidence-based class? Medicine-based class, or is there a course where you can assist reading other students' posters, presentation? And then a lot of times as the mentor, like we'd be doing even from a clinical standpoint, is helping get that student's presentations or your colleagues' presentations to a national level. And again, as Craig would say, go low and start slow. So try to get a poster into your area chapter, annual meeting. And maybe you got to do that on your own. Maybe you got to work with your hospital and get the paperwork figured out and say, I really want to put this case study out there as a poster. So even though it's a small poster, it's still one poster on your CV. Okay. And then again, talk to the people that you're interested teaching for. See if they have a research line that you can help with. And say, if I help you with this project or I help you in your lab, even volunteer, remember, even helping to do data collection, volunteer, or helping to do some prep work or some Excel sheets, those would be ways that you could potentially get on someone else's research and tag team onto that to get that onto your CV. Was there anything else, Danu, that you wanted me to comment on? Please forgive me if I didn't remember all the aims of your question there.
No, I think that's a really extensive and really helpful way to approach getting involved in those areas of the scholarship, the service, and the teaching. So to follow up on that, I don't think that people should view any of those as as too small to be beneficial. So when we're coming up and looking at potential faculty candidates and they show a poster, that looks good to me because that shows that you've put in the effort to go through that process and you have an idea of that process specifically. It's understood too that people that don't have a PhD or an EdD or a DSci, those types of terminal academic degrees, we're not expecting you to have a huge research line or a track record of publication. And most teaching positions are primarily teaching focused, not necessarily research focused. So I think it can be overwhelming at times to think about the things that are not on your CV, but to really emphasize the things that are, or your capacity to be that person that has scholarship service in teaching. I think that's huge. And that kind of brings me into my own little soapbox, I guess. But, you know, I personally think knowledge translation starts with entry-level programs. I think it's harder, and we've seen this in the last however many years of the science of knowledge translation. It's hard to get people to change their minds, and it's hard to identify where they are and what they want to do, how they're going to do something different. But I think if we start with entry-level students to facilitate knowledge translation there, it's the most important thing. To get them to facilitate knowledge translation, I think they need clinicians teaching them. So I'm a very strong advocate of clinicians being educators, whether it's in the clinic or it's academics.
Yeah, I had a few comments on that, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah, please jump in.
So I've been in academics a long time, and as a result of that, I have worked with people who haven't been back in the clinic for quite some time, yet have been teaching a class for 10 years. And if you're trying to find a way to maybe get a niche or try to find a way to be able to put your two cents in as a clinician, those types of classes often need that breath of fresh air. Danu, just like you had mentioned, we want the clinicians teaching the students because they bring real life examples into the classroom, right? So for me, I was at an institution and I kept hearing from the students that I had in a very, very different class, okay, saying, we're trying to learn this stuff and the person hasn't seen a patient in 10 years. So Mary Beth, can you help us? Can you help us with this assignment? Can you help us with this homework? Can you help us move forward with what we need to get done? And if you can do it in a very professional and a nice, easy, ginger way, I would go up to that professor and say, hey, I know you and I have not worked together. And I know you and I have, these different areas of expertise, but I'm helping some of your students with this project that they're struggling with. Do you think it'd be helpful to them for me to come in and do a case example in your class, right? Maybe help tie this project together. And maybe after that's done and it's graded, I just show them how that would be put together. And sometimes by just doing that nicely and saying it professionally, there's an opportunity, again, for a clinician to get into a classroom, even if it's one time, right? Or these lunch and learns that a lot of institutions do, or these brown bag seminars or Thursday seminars. Those are other ways where you can show off your clinical skills in an academic setting, and you never know what kind of opportunities those might bring to someone.
To kind of bounce on top of that, following the discussions we've had so far, what are some take-home kind of key points of advice you would give, whether someone's been out for 2 years, maybe someone's been out for 30 years, and they're thinking about going into academics? What advice would you have for that person?
Okay, so let's think about this. Some take-home advice for those of you out there who are interested in moving forward into academics. I cannot stress enough to network, right? Network within the people you know, and like really use AOMP, use your connections here with this great and awesome institution to try to just find out like where's the need, or could I come to your school at a different time and take a vacation day or come and help you out and do something. When you would be looking at your networking circle, I always tell people, look at your circle and look at who's not in your circle. So I learned early on from a very, very good mentor who said to me, Mary Beth, you don't have enough business people in your networking circle. You need to meet them. You need to talk to them. You need to find out how you can interject your life into their world. Okay. And then that business individual comes and, you know, becomes part of my circle and moves forward. And he's like, well, who's mentoring you on this aspect, right? Like financial literacy. Do you think you could go out and see a few patients on the side and create a name for yourself with an LLC? And I'm like, well, I don't know. And he's like, well, let me help you. Let me help you with that part. Okay. Well, then that's where this whole thing just kind of keeps spiraling, right? So you're interested in academics, right? Take a look at who's in your circle. Are all those network people bunched together, right? Are they all ortho people? Because you need someone other than ortho in your circle, right? And then if those people in your circle of orthopedics carry over into manual therapy, like that's a little bit still too similar, right? Could you branch out and use a skill that you have from the clinic to help catapult the next part forward? The other piece of advice that I want to tell everybody that is out there is don't take suggestions personally, right? I've had some times when I've taken classes I just shouldn't have taught, or they were just bad timing for my family, bad timing for how hard they were, to how much effort they needed. And someone had to come back to me and say, Mary Beth, do you think that was a good fit? And I had to not take it personally, because for me, I thought I did a really good job teaching the class, which again, maybe the course eval say you did a good job, but they could tell that I came into the school every day, parked my car, hurried into class, taught lab, ran back. And anytime they called me, I said, can you wait a minute? I got to go help this kid. Okay. Can I call you back in 20 minutes? Can I go do this? And she says, did that really fit into your life at the moment? Right. So just remember, they make a suggestion. Don't take it personally. Take it as a growth opportunity and move forward with that. And I would say the other piece of advice that I would give anybody interested in just kind of moving forward would be try to just do self-reflection way more often than you think you need it. Okay. At the end of every day, at the end of every week, at the end of every month, and at the end of every class, any class that you've helped with. I sat there one time at a lab that nothing went well. Everything was horrific. And I still came home and said, I'm just glad we were able to get that done for the students, because had we not got through all that garbage, we would not be able to move forward with next lab, right? Whether it was they were complaining about their midterm schedule, the D2L, you know, platform didn't load up their assignment correctly, none of the online quizzes were working. And I just had to go home and be like, wow, we got a lot of work to do at this class. I'm not sure I'm the one who can fix it, but I'm definitely the one who can tell the professor where the problems are, right? So without that self-reflection, you might have to take a step back and start over, and then use those self-reflections as a way for you to make the next, you know, very, very important change in your life to kind of move forward.
No, those are great points. And I would kind of especially echo the growth mindset. You know, I think we kind of expect our students now to take our criticism or feedback and use it positively. If we're going to expect our students to do that, we have to do that too. You know, and being in this for as long as I've been in it and submitting as many things as I've submitted, I've published a few things, but I've gotten rejected a bunch, you know, and you can't take those things personally. You think about how you can get better from it. That's true in the clinic. That's true in the classroom. And also, I think some of my emphasis has kind of been discussing the academic side, but I also teach in orthopedic residencies and fellowships. And I know similar kind of concepts and principles apply in the mentoring of those programs too. So I think your topic and your discussion is so important, because it's not just getting into teaching in the traditional face-to-face lecture kind of setting, but it's these hybrid, it's these mentoring kind of positions. There's a lot of opportunities. And I think the first step is just identifying, you know, am I interested in teaching? Well, if so, I think your presentation brings up a lot of good points, and it brings up a lot of good ideas on how to start that process. So I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, let me talk about one little quick caveat there, is just the difference between teaching and all those avenues, if that's okay. So I've taught and started in a program before it was a DPT, and I had to learn how to up my game, right? When we were now requiring those students to become doctors of physical therapy. Any lab we had done previously for a bachelor's or master's program needed to be moved ahead. Well, now fast forward 10 years into my teaching career, and I started being able to work with fellows. So I graduated from Regis University with my fellowship certificate. And as a result of that, was asked to come back and help teach for them. So by that time, they already knew that I had some past experience, but that was a big leap of faith for me, because now you're accountable for everything that you just passed your test for, right? All your articles, all your statistical facts, things like that. Well, once you teach in a fellowship program, you have to take a big step back and then not have too high of expectations for those people who are finishing their DPT degree. So that took me about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, to get my brain to separate what were my expectations for the differences between those programs, right? So when Mike came in and did part of his talk for our little segment at the AOM conference, he talked through like mentoring and requirements for residency versus fellowship program. But for those of you interested in academics, like, make sure you know where you want to be challenged, right? At a fellowship level program, you are going to be challenged in ways you never even thought you would if you pursue that for your academic job, right? Everyone's going to be on top of things. Sometimes a student will be more ingrained in a topic than you are. And then you have to remember to be mindful and to think about that and to listen to them. I would say my biggest challenge that happened to me just recently in the last, to say, year or so, was when I actually got asked to teach in a residency program. So I had to take my brain from, okay, I know what DPT students need to learn and what they're accountable for. I know the kind of high expectations we have for fellows. And I've even tested fellows out on their final national exam, right, through Regis University. But I had to come back to a middle ground and actually remind my brain, how do I get my expectations to fit for a resident, right? It's more than a DPT, but less than a fellow. And I would say to those of you out there in academics, think about, could you just take one topic and separate out the difference between what you think a DPT would know, what you think a resident should know, and how accountable a fellow should be for that topic? And if you think you can get your brain to go down each of those paths, and how would you write an assignment differently if you were going to teach in those three different types of institutions? If you find a love for one of those three, that might be another option for you to consider when you're doing your own self-reflection for where do you want to teach.
That's a great point. And so thinking about the expectations of each type of learner and where do your skills best match teaching and mentoring, where does your interest match that? I think that's a good starting point. If you are interested in teaching, kind of thinking about where would I like to teach, what setting, what level, and starting there. So, and then once you do have that interest and you do have that idea, maybe following this roadmap that you, Mike, Jody, and Craig put together to accommodate and actually to move forward on that path, I think that's huge. So I really do appreciate you all putting this this presentation together. For me, it's extremely interesting. I could be here for hours and hours and hours, but obviously I got other things to do, and so do our listeners, and so do you. But all that being said, we're going to tag your contact information in our show notes. Is it okay if our listeners go ahead and reach out to you and maybe your presentation team if they have any questions about any specifics of their path?
Yeah, and hopefully I want everyone to know who's listening to this podcast that if someone didn't help me early on, I wouldn't be where I am today, right? So please reach out to our committee, reach out to the ACF SIG through AOMP. We would love to be able to at least facilitate conversation and see where things would best help you, those of you that are out there and who are interested in academics.
And I really appreciate your time, Dr. Mary Beth Geiser. Thanks so much for taking the time to put this presentation together. And thanks for debriefing on this presentation with us for this podcast. I appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT.
The views and opinions expressed on the AOMT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.